Welcome to the USECB First Freedom Podcast. I'm Aaron Weldon.
Hi, and I'm Mary McCleskey.
And here to help Mary and me out today, this is our first time to have her on, is Marissa Eckelkamp, who is a policy advisor on marriage and family issues here at the USECB. And it's kind of funny, Marissa, actually, I don't know that we've ever even actually met each other in the office. So it's thank you for being a part of this. And it's good to finally meet you.
No, it's great to meet you too. And yeah, that's how it goes. You know, there's so many people working at the office and everyone's been so wonderful. So it's great to meet, even if it's via Zoom.
Yeah. I'm glad that you're able to do this with us. So today's discussion is actually not about religious liberty exactly. But it is about a topic that we and the Religious Liberty Office are often confronted with, and that's the issue of gender identity. And so we have probably one of the best people I can imagine to talk to us about this topic today. Joining us, we have Abigail Favale, a writer and professor whose work lies at the intersection of Catholic theology, literature, and women's studies. Dr. Favale is professor of the practice at the McGrath Institute for Church Life at Notre Dame. Her abiding interest as a writer and scholar is the meaning and dignity of woman, and her work explores sexual difference and embodiment in the Catholic imagination. Her most recent book, The Genesis of Gender, A Christian Theory, was published by Ignatius Press in 2022. That's kind of going to be the basis of our conversation, but we may get into some other more recent. You just had an article in just a couple months ago that was published. Maybe that'll may have some questions about that too, but thank you so much, Dr. Favale. I know you're busy, so thank you so much for joining us for this today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So first, I thought it'd be good just to start right off the bat with the title of your book, The Genesis of Gender. There's kind of a double meaning there. On the one hand, yes, indeed, you're talking about the origins of this concept of gender identity. But you're also alluding to scripture and kind of some of the different ways, mythological accounts of sexual difference. So talk about that a little bit. What's going on with the title, The Genesis of Gender?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There's kind of a double meaning there. So in the book, I present a more or less linear story of how the term gender entered the scene in the early 20th century in a way that it hadn't before, and how it began to take on new meanings, a continual metamorphosis that has only escalated in our time. So that's one way in which the title makes sense. What is the genesis or the genealogy of the term gender? And but you're also right that it alludes to the book of Genesis, because in addition to giving that kind of linear story, I also provide a worldview comparison between what I call the gender paradigm, or the kind of framework or worldview behind a lot of gender theory that's out there. And then I compare that to the worldview or the understanding of gender that's given to us in the Christian faith, especially in the book of Genesis.
Dr. Favale, I was wondering if you could talk just a little bit about the difference between sex and gender, right? There's even these debates in some circles, like what do we use? What's proper? What's the best, you know, kind of the Catholic kind of perspective on when to use which term and why, right? So could you just maybe share your thoughts on that?
Oh yeah. I mean, I laughed when you asked that question to me, because it's such an important question. It's also such a huge question. And it's hard for me to be succinct, because it's a messy question. But let me just give like a quick overview of maybe three kind of possibilities on offer into how to use those terms. And then I'll give my sense of which one's probably the best. So people of a certain age who've taken women's studies or feminist theory classes will probably immediately think about sex and gender in terms of the classic sex gender split in feminist theory, which is that sex refers to biology, and then gender refers to the cultural interpretations of sex. And usually in feminist theory, gender is kind of seen as oppressive, whereas sex is just the way things are, right? It's just a basic fact about being human. But whereas gender is more something that we should kind of critique or contest or overthrow or try to revise. And that distinction kind of makes sense, right? Because there are norms related to the sexes that aren't strictly biological or natural norms, like hair length, just to name one easy example, right? So in that framing, gender would refer to things like women tend to have long hair and wear skirts, whereas men don't, whereas sex has to do with biology. So that's one option. Another option, which has become, I think, more the dominant view in our time, would be that, well, that gender refers to a subjective sense of self as male or female or man or woman. So this is often called gender identity. So this is more of a subjectivist view of gender, where it's this like internal sense of self. And so in that view, sometimes one's sex is even dictated by one's gender identity. Or sometimes you might say, well, there's sex and then there's gender identity, right? So that's one option. And then there's kind of the option of just talking about sex and gender interchangeably. Like they're just two different words to name the same reality, which is that the human species has two ways of being human that are distinguished by their co-generative powers, right? One sex or gender has the potential for fatherhood. One sex or gender has the potential for motherhood, right? So in that view, it's really rooted in embodiment, right? So I would say that no matter how or why you're using the terms, you need to define what you mean by them now, because the terrain is so confused. So you'll have people using gender and meaning totally different things by it. And so I would say, from a Catholic perspective, it's okay to conflate the two. Like, it's okay to see gender as so rooted in sex that we can use those terms pretty much interchangeably. However, I think it's important to be very precise when maybe writing a theological article or talking about church documents or legal documents to use the term sex, because gender is like this many-headed, like Hydra monster that could mean all these different things. And it is worth noting that in kind of more the official documents of the church and in magisterial teaching, the term that's used is sex and sexual identity, and that's what is meant. But I think it's okay to use the term gender casually, kind of interchangeably with sex, because it's really about the body.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, scripture, male and female, he created them. That's another option. But even that, I mean, yeah, you're right. It is a messy conversation.
Yeah, it is messy. So I wish I was like, oh, that's real simple. Let's just use language this way. I mean, it's just in the moment we live in right now, we just have to be strategic about which kind of words we use. And to be aware that someone we're dialoguing with might be using the terms very differently. Yeah. So, I mean, in some ways, what's unfortunate is that we have to now define things that have previously been held to be so commonsensical that they didn't need to be said. Right. Sometimes I get in conversations with people about like what the church's understanding of woman is. And I have to like make the argument that when the church talks about woman or man in the kind of man in the male sense, it's always connected to fruitfulness. Like it's always grounded in the potential for fruitfulness. Like you can't separate out, well, there's femaleness over here and then there's woman over here. Cause in the church's understanding, like those things are just intertwined. But you can't like say, oh, here's where it says that in the catechism, right? Because it's just assumed that everyone kind of knows that a woman has a potential for motherhood and a man does not, and vice versa, right? But we now live in a time where these things need to be like kind of unpacked even more.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that about your book, because you go into Butler and Foucault and how language is manipulated. And I think, you know, when it comes to gender ideology now, and the idea of sex versus gender, you see this manipulation of language and how it's, I think, to quote you, it's like this new social truth script. I really liked how you phrase that, through this like exercise of power. I thought that was a really good way to put that.
I do think it's a challenge for us at the Bishops Conference, because often what we write has to be so succinct. And so we don't really have a place where we can define our terms ahead of time. And in your recent article, you talk about this, that most people aren't steeped in these debates. And so they use sex and gender interchangeably. But, you know, with our audience, there's going to be, you know, just regular people who aren't steeped in these things. And there's going to be people who maybe are reading you almost in bad faith. And just, and so if you use the term gender, they're going to be like, oh, see, the bishops are all bought into the gender identity framework. You know, or, you know, so it's just that it really is a challenge with when it comes to when words are being used in such different ways by different communities, and you're trying to speak to all of those different or audiences, you're trying to speak to all of them.
Absolutely. I mean, I feel like we're left with a lot of bad options, basically, because of the linguistic confusion. Like, there's no easy way out. But I think clarity is just so important. So whatever that means in terms of like taking the time to clearly define words, or it might make sense, especially given the fact that the magisterium does have a way of speaking about this that is consistent, just to keep using that consistency. Although I think it might, in certain contexts, there has to be kind of a clarification around that term. Because when gender has kind of popped into some magisterial documents, like the 2019 document from the Congregation for Catholic Education on gender theory, which is kind of the biggest document that's really responded to it. And I think what's hard is that responding even to gender theory, there's kind of like multiple gender theories. And, you know, the two definitions I gave, or the kind of two framings I gave earlier, where you have the kind of way that gender has been used in feminist theory as like a social construct, you have that theory of gender. And then you have the theory of gender as this innate sense of self. So you've got this constructionist gender theory and this subjectivist gender theory, right? And so sometimes when church documents will respond to gender theory, they're usually aiming at the subject or at the constructionist, right? So I think it's also helpful to say both of those are at odds with the Catholic anthropology in different ways, right? So there has to be, I think, kind of an attention to the different understandings, not only the definitions of gender that are out there, but also the kind of implicit philosophical positions behind those definitions.
Well, so Mary kind of started us off with a big question, and now I have another big question, which is about your, you know, you have this chapter that covers the different waves of feminism. Marissa kind of alluded to that earlier, and I thought that's kind of a helpful chapter, not only for kind of mapping out, you know, where things have been and where they might be going, but you know, I was thinking about it even, you know, even in my own life, how early on in my marriage, my wife and I might have been seen as somewhat progressive because we didn't have very strict gender roles. Now I think that we might be seen as reactionaries because we don't think drag queens should perform for children or things like, you know, I mean, it's sort of like how things have changed so much in a relatively short time, but you kind of give a sense for how these things have changed, these different waves of not just feminism, but, you know, gender theory in general. Mm-hmm. So how do we get there? How do we get from wanting just basic equality for women, or saying like, well, men and women should be treated the same, and not the same, but they should be treated with equal dignity, to having trouble saying what a woman is? That seems like a long arc. So another big question, but can you give us at least a little bit of a sketch of how do we get there?
Sure. Yeah. Cause I think there's kind of a two threads to track, that are intertwined, right? Cause they're, when we look at say the mid 20th century to now, this ongoing maybe revolution, like a twofold revolution in how we think about gender. You have a conceptual revolution, which is kind of what we've been talking about, like the kind of changing understandings of what gender even is. But that's very much tied up in a technological revolution that's happening at the same time. And so one of the big pieces of technology in that revolution that I talk about in the book is contraception. And so one of the arguments I make is that the technology of contraception has also reshaped the way we think as a culture, kind of our cultural imagination, so to speak, because we've essentially kind of taken the reality of generativity and generative potential, and we've kind of taken it and really sidelined it over here. Like, this is something that's kind of an optional feature of being human, that you can, like, a switch you can flip on if you want to, but the default setting is kind of off. And so I think that in becoming contraceptive, our culture, that shifted our understanding of men and women to where it's not primarily about generative potential, but it becomes about things like what clothes you wear or what roles you play in society. It becomes more about these externalities. And when it becomes not about the structure and potential inherent in the body and becomes much more about kind of cultural expressions, then it is more plausible for a man to become a woman or vice versa, right? If it's more about kind of adopting a role or an appearance or certain ways of dressing or expression. Right. So I think that's one piece of how we've gotten there. And it is ironic because, you know, I think in the book I use the phrase that gender theory or the gender paradigm is the Oedipal offspring of feminism, right? As in, like, Oedipus, like, that kills its own mother. So, you know, I do think I make the argument that these ideas of gender in large part come from feminism, but then they ironically kind of saw off the branch that feminism is sitting on by making it very difficult to make the case that there is such a thing as woman that requires a movement to defend her dignity. Yeah. So, and I think that even though I put a lot of focus on contraception in the book, I think there are other technologies that drive this as well, especially the internet and social media in our time. So I would say the turn toward more of a subjectivist view of gender is driven really a lot by how immersed we are in online identities and how we begin to see a sense of self as this kind of avatar that you curate and that you put together and you present to the world, right? So you can, online, you can kind of be anyone you want to be. You could be like a dwarf, you know, magician, you know. So I think all these like features of kind of online youth culture in terms of online fan communities and role-playing games and even just things like Instagram where you can kind of curate your own image. I think all of these are also, it's kind of a technology that's having an effect on how we even conceive of what identity means anymore. And it becomes this like construction of the self.
You know, bringing the internet thing or an online culture, I remember being struck one time by a story I read about, I think you would have called her a desister, not a detransitioner, because she never underwent any kind of transition treatments. But her parents were actually very supportive when she said that she wanted to be a man. They just said she wasn't old enough. But she was spending, she in her account, you probably read this because I know from your book you read a lot of these kinds of accounts. Not to go into details, but the basic gist of it was that she spent a lot of time like on Tumblr and YouTube but she was also going through a time in her life, and just a lot of kids are kind of having a hard time, you know, but she came to be convinced that it was her gender identity was the thing and that she could resolve these issues by transitioning. But then she says that then this one summer she spent just working on a farm where she really didn't have access to the internet, and just everything just sort of went away. Now, obviously that wouldn't necessarily happen for every single individual, but it was striking in this particular person's case that not being online all the time and acting in the material world seemed to like have this significant effect on her. And so it's just, I just can't help but wonder to what extent spending so much time in this sort of disembodied kind of world. I mean, that's a lot of online culture. So it leads you to a kind of disembodied sense of self. how much that plays a role in all of this.
Yeah. And it even goes down the path of, you know, like the young girls now who are identifying as cats. And, you know, now we have artificial intelligence and robots that will be our boyfriends and girlfriends now, you know. So it's almost like, is that an extension of that disembodiment that is an extension of this trend of confusing gender and sex? So have you tackled the whole artificial intelligence thought pattern at all, Dr. Favalli?
Not really. I mean, I have done some research on Tumblr. I really do think that in terms of technologies, especially in the era of Tumblr's heyday, which would have been in, I don't know, kind of 2011 to 2014. And that's when you really see this gender confusion escalating in young people. And you see like the demographics of gender dysphoria really begin to radically shift and skew much more female and much younger. It's in the era of Tumblr. And so I have done some research on that, a kind of Tumblr as a trans technology. And so I guess in some ways I see a lot of these, the kind of online technological influences being interconnected in different ways. I mean, there is the disembodiment piece and the kind of focus on the avatar, you know, the identity as an avatar. So it's almost like trying to bring that malleability that exists online into the real world and onto the body itself. And so in some ways, I think that what we're seeing in gender is connected to the broader kind of project or question of transhumanism, right? And how far we can or should use technology to rewrite human nature and natural limits. So I do see these phenomena as very interconnected.
You kind of alluded to it, but I think it's probably would be helpful just to have you at least just say briefly on this issue of on we don't know what a woman is. What would you say makes a woman a woman? Again, you've touched on it in answering other questions, but mm-hmm. It might be helpful just to hear, like, how would you put it?
Sure. So, I mean, in a nutshell, like the kind of one sentence definition I would give of what is a woman, I would say a woman is the kind of human being who has the potential to gestate life or the potential for motherhood. You could say that. Now, potential, I think, is a really important word to unpack because I'm using that in a precise way that would include any human female, whether she is postmenopausal, prepubescent, or struggles with infertility, because all of those women have the potential for motherhood, even if there's a condition that's preventing that from being fully actualized. And even the category of infertility indicates an innate potential that's not able to be actualized, right? So you wouldn't say, like a kind of male wouldn't go to the doctor and say, "Doctor, I can't get pregnant, I must be infertile," right? Because a male doesn't have that potentiality for pregnancy. So even kind of the category of infertility kind of points back to the fact that men and women have by nature a different kind of set of potentialities when it comes to generativity. And so that's what defines us as men and women, is it's really rooted in that potential, which impacts the entire structure of the organism, right? That's another thing. It's not just about like body parts. It's not just about like uterus, you know, but a woman's body and every system in her body somehow participates in this potentiality. And so it affects the entire person.
So that I love that. But I'm also wondering does that focus on the biology of the woman versus, I mean, you know, for example, religious sisters, they do have that potential to generate life, but they also have this other potential of their spiritual motherhood. So could you kind of, is there any way of tying that in as well? Like, is that a more kind of robust, or you're just trying to keep it very simple based on kind of more from an embodiment angle?
Well, I see those as connected, right? Well, why does a religious sister have the potential for spiritual motherhood? Why? Like, you know, how would you answer that question? Well, it's because she's a woman. So she has the potential for motherhood, right? You wouldn't say that, like, you know, a priest has the potential for spiritual motherhood. You know, no, he has the potential for spiritual fatherhood, right? So this is just kind of the next dimension, because human beings, we're not just bodies, we're unities, we're composites of bodies and body and soul. So what is present at the body, like the body indicates a spiritual reality, right? This is, you know, kind of John Paul II might say something like the body reveals the person. Edith Stein would even kind of pushes that even, I think, further. So she very much sees, like, if some kind of potential is exhibited in the body, that can only arise from an underlying spiritual reality, right? So the physical is really an expression of what is first and foremost spiritual, but in the human person, they're inseparable, right? They're wholly united. So from the perspective of a Catholic anthropology, you have to kind of pull in both things. But I think my basic definition still works, you know, especially in the potential for motherhood language, like a woman is the kind of human being who has the potential for motherhood. And then you could extend that and just say, like, that has both a biological and a spiritual dimension, right? So that potentiality can be realized in different ways. And every woman participates in that reality, whether or not she has her own children, right? That potentiality still shapes her life in a profound way.
I remember one time hearing in a lecture, a Dominican theologian point out that language of potentiality is helpful, because too often in these debates, sometimes people want to go just directly to DNA. Like, that's the main mm-hmm. thing. And he was like, it's not the fullest. It doesn't give you the fullest picture of what's really happening. And talking about it in terms of potentiality is a much richer understanding and motherhood and fatherhood, rather than just saying it's about chromosomes. But that's the only thing because that's just such a thin account. So I want to shift a little bit. When I read this book, one of the things that I was not expecting when I first started it was how personal that it often is. On the one hand, as we've been talking about, you have these historical accounts of feminism, different debates about gender theory and that sort of thing. But interspersed with all that, you also have a lot of reflections on your own life, your experiences, your conversions, or the way you've changed your mind on some different things, and your spiritual conversion. Why did you chose to approach the book that way? Was that kind of a conscious choice, or did it just feel like the most natural way, or did that just feel kind of like the most natural way to write this?
Yeah, that's a good question. In some ways I'm like, why did I do that? You know, because I think it is natural. I would say my kind of favorite mode of writing is a nonfiction, but with a personal element to it. But I think it's also strategic because I have this sort of odd history of being, I guess, like a native citizen of that world, or maybe not native, but certainly a citizen of that world for a long time in my adult life, but then becoming Catholic. Because of that, like, not only does that help me kind of intellectually navigate both worlds, but it also means that I'm very aware of, I guess, what it's like to, I'm very aware of kind of the personal reality of people who believe different things, right? And so in some ways, I'm hoping, like, it's kind of an effective way of drawing people in to some of the ideas, and also showing how these ideas aren't just ideas, but they actually impact and very much shape how we live in the world and what kinds of experiences we have. So I do find it helpful and I guess I'm kind of a weirdo because I love theology, but I also have a very literary imagination. So I love to engage with theology, but from a literary imagination. So that means I'm constantly mining my own life, but also just the world around me for examples to kind of ground some of the more abstract ideas, which is funny now that I'm talking about it, is a very it kind of reflects the subject matter where I'm talking about like the concrete revealing what is kind of transcendent, right? So in some ways, like using that strategy of the concrete realities of my own life as a way of kind of getting at some of these deeper spiritual truths.
I guess part of the reason that the question came up for me is because you were raised in an evangelical household. Is that mm-hmm. right? So that's my background too. And I sort of, some of what I was reading, I was like, oh, this sort of reminds me of like a personal testimony kind mm-hmm. of,
yeah.
You know, as a sort of a common
yeah.
way of communicating. So anyway, that was kind of like reading mm-hmm. it. That was like what kind of one of the things that struck me about it.
Yeah.
Well, I only have one more question, but I want to make sure, because I've sort of, I don't want to dominate the conversation. So if, Marissa, if you have any final questions you wanted to ask before I wrap it up.
No, I just really enjoyed reading the book, and I thought it was a really useful book in that it went to the very, you know, beginning, the Genesis. I thought mm-hmm. that's, you know, as we are dealing with these terms that are emerging and these ideologies, that, you know, we understand where they come from and how they impact us. So I just thought that the book was a wonderful way that, you know, anyone, I think, from any background can, you know, get a good sense of what that is.
Well, my final question it's somewhat practical. You mentioned, you know, wanting to be somewhat practical or concrete. And it's kind of what you get at the end of the book is, how can we talk about these issues, especially with people who may disagree with us or who see these things differently? I will say this is one of the things I appreciate the most about your work is that it's humane in terms of how you want to speak with different audiences. You know, how can we be both truthful and charitable when we talk to people about these things? And you give lots of little nice kind of stories. And so that's why that's one of the things I really liked about those last chapters of this book. So can you give us some help here?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the question, really. Like that is then the one I was grappling with when I wrote the book and has continued to grapple with since I wrote the book. Because I think it requires ongoing discernment and figuring out how to respond to a particular person in the right way at the right time. So, I mean, I think there are times when it's important to go there, I guess, and to present the truth. There are also times when it's just important to have a neighborly interaction with someone and not go there, you know? Before I moved here, in Oregon, I moved here from Oregon. I would go to the local dog park a lot. And for some reason, I had so many encounters with trans people at the dog park. And I don't know why. I always felt a little bit providential, because it was like while I was writing this book, I would take my dog to the park and there would be like a trans person and we would just talk, you know? And we never talked about this stuff, you know? Like we talked about dogs. and there was one particular person who, you know, and this was, and I'm kind of an introvert too. So like sometimes I'm like over in the corner sitting on a picnic table, you know, like I don't really talk to people very easily. But this one day, this person came over and talked to me and then just started like spilling their story, you know, and I just listened and chatted. And what I love about those interactions is that nobody ever asked for anybody's pronouns, right? Like when you're talking with someone, you don't even really need to ask that question, right? You're just kind of talking one-on-one with someone. So in some ways, like those sort of interactions are easier to navigate because you can just talk to someone like a human being. And it would have been weird for me to suddenly kind of bring up gender or like, you know, so like there has to be this kind of neighborly interaction, right? So those sorts of interactions, I think it's just very important to engage with someone as a person, as a neighbor. And then there are times when, I think in certain contexts where you have to give an account of what it is to, of the truth, and to do so in love. And I guess maybe some kind of strategies about how to do that is one to, you know, I think there's always like a nugget or a seed of truth behind every heresy, if you want to put it that way, or behind, and it often has to do with what people are looking for. You know, that's one of the first things that Jesus asks people when he meets them? What are you looking for? You know, what is the desire that's driving a person? What is the good that they're seeking? Because, you know, I think Augustine's right about this, that that's what human beings do. Even when we fall into error, it's we're still, you know, trying, we're seeking after something that's good. So I think a strategy when engaging with someone could be to find, like, where are the shared values or the shared goods maybe that you're seeking. But I think, I don't know, it's so hard to generalize, right? Because I really think when it comes to truth, like this kind of question about how do we engage with someone in truth and love, like the devil or God is in the details, because it has so much to do with your role in relation to the person, the kind of context in which you're engaging, what is being asked of you in that moment, right? So I think it does require this kind of docility to the spirit, but always keeping hold of the personhood of the person you're engaging with. And also knowing, being able to discern when someone isn't engaging in a spirit of goodwill and it's just not fruitful to have that, you know, to engage with. I don't think it's usually ever fruitful to engage with someone who is, like, you know, not coming from a spirit of goodwill. So sometimes you have to kind of cut your losses, you know?
Yeah. I'm glad you made that last point, because there are times, kind of like Aaron, I live in a neighborhood where we have flags and yard signs, you know, hate does not live here and all these things. And it's at times it can feel very like, just by walking the dog, I'm attacked by these signs, right? Oh, I'm reminded, like, oh, what I think is abhorrent to some people. So I love that idea of just sometimes you don't have to engage, sometimes just on these topics at all, just being a good neighbor and by your witness of your life and being kind and seeing the Christ in them, right? Is fine, right? Can be a starting point at least.
Yeah, saying that also, that it's difficult at this at a high level of generality to say, well, this is the technique or this is what you should do. Speaking charitably and truthfully probably will just come easier if you become a charitable person. So, I mean, and that may be done in different ways, but just, I mean, even if it's just, you know, something simple like trying to pray for people or try to develop a thought habit of seeing the best intentions and what others and what other people are just sort of trying to make their way in a confusing world. Things like that may be ways that you can change the way you are, rather than say, well, what's the trick and what's the right thing to say? You just have to be truthful and charitable to be a truthful and charitable person. Well, Professor Favale, this is super helpful conversation, and I really enjoyed the book and also your recent article in Church Life Journal just this past January. I have it right here. I realized looking up at my screen, I could see it in the background, so it shows you. Oh, yeah. I was doing my homework. I have to print these things out because evidence. I can't do the disembodied thing.
It's good. So, it's good.
You know that I read it if it's printed out. But so, is Gender Too Troubled, most recent article, very good one. Anyway, I appreciate you taking your time out to join us today, and everything you're doing, great work. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for the work that you all are doing for the church. So really appreciate that.
So we've been talking with Dr. Abigail Favale of the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame. I'm Aaron Weldon.
And I'm Mary McCluskey. Thank you for joining us for this episode of the First Freedom Podcast.
And I don't want to neglect that we were joined also by Marissa Eckelkamp. Marissa, thank you for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
All right. Good to talk to y'all. Thank you.